Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment on this Martin Luther King Day and discuss the State of the Dream 2011, Austerity for Whom? The title of a new study by United for a Fair Economy. Mazer Ali, the co-author of this study that examines the racial divide in America's economy, joins us. Then we'll examine the effectiveness of the Obama Foreign Policy and National Security Team with National Security Council veteran Roger Morris, who is completing a history of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. Then we'll be joined in the studio by Francis McGahey, who made the documentary The Best Government Money Can Buy. He will give us an update on what is really going on behind the scenes as the new Congress grandstands with a futile vote on repealing health care, while the new head of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, who charged that the Obama administration is the most corrupt in history, finds himself the target of a devastating investigation. So stay tuned. And let me begin on this celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday by examining a new analysis of the economic state of Black America. I'm speaking with Mazer Ali, who is the co-author of The State of the Dream 2011, Austerity for Whom?, a new report published by United for a Fair Economy that examines the effects conservative fiscal policies have had upon African Americans, Latinos, and other groups that have suffered disproportionately from the economic downturn. Thank you for joining us today on Background Briefing, Mazer Ali.
Yeah, hi. How are you, Ian?
Very well, thanks. Now, in terms of course, your title, The State of the Dream 2011, Austerity for Whom? Certainly refers to Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday we're celebrating here today. So, give us the bad news.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be bad news, but
it sounds like it is, though. I mean,
it's hopefully a wake up call. Hopefully, it's a wake up call. The reason we put this report out is because right now we're hearing the roar of this new wave of elected officials that were just voted into office at the federal, state, and local levels. And a lot of what we're hearing is the need to reduce the deficit, the need to cut taxes and shrink government, cut social safety nets. And the reason we put this report out is to talk about the impact of such an agenda on our communities and our communities of color in particular.
So how does this relate to the political changes in this country? You're responding to a recent change where the right wing had a lot of victories in the last election, and we can analyze them. A lot of people think it had a lot to do with the Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance. But at the end of the day, what seemed to happen in the last midterm elections were a lot of angry white people voted and not enough progressives and minorities voted. So Is this the basic reality that we have now?
Well, you know, I mean, I think to speculate about what led to all these victories. I mean, certainly the conservative wing of our national politics gained a lot of momentum, and that's something that's been building ever since Obama was elected into office. But you know, we can't really point our fingers at this election cycle and say, okay, well, this is cause for all the bad news, because really the circumstances that we're in right now, particularly for people of color, is something that's been building for decades and decades and decades.
Well, it's actually, I think you could argue that minorities, particularly African Americans, have had to fight their way back or the way out of enormous political, social, and economic disadvantage.
Absolutely, absolutely, and they continue to fight. I think one of the things that we highlight in the report was progress made by people of color, by black workers, black families, in two distinct periods. One being from the 40s to the 70s, and we're talking about one of the largest economic expansions in U.S. history, versus the gains made in the last 30 some odd year period. And what we found is that in that post-World War II period, even though that expansion was driven by a lot of racially exclusive policies, things that prevented black folk from being able to take advantage of the same government benefits as white folk, even though that was the case, we found that they, that communities of color were making greater progress in that post-World War II period than they have in the last 30-some-odd years.
And I was just trying again, Mazhar Ali, the co-author of United for a Fair Economy's new report, State of the Dream, 2011, Austerity for Whom? I was trying to sort of track the political changes in this country on the basis that we have a kind of winner-take-all government, and now I think it should be blatantly obvious to most people who are paying attention, particularly with the compromise that the president had to make in order to continue unemployment benefits for the record number of people out of work. He had to swallow the idea that that the billionaires in this country need tax breaks continued and their estate taxes cut, all of which happened because the Republican Party made that their bottom line and they wouldn't budge. So we know we know what their priorities are. My what troubles me is, you know, it's everybody at the lower end of the economic food chain in this country is getting an incredibly bad deal, and I'm trying to understand the relationship between that and political action, because the real political action seems to be on the far right with these Tea Partiers, these angry Tea Partiers who are getting their way.
Yeah, I'd say so. Certainly in this, certainly with the tax deal that was passed in December 2010, that was advanced by President Obama with, you know, largely GOP support. But, you know, I think something that, that you mentioned earlier that, we've got this kind of winner take all, you know, political arena. And that's something that, I think is also apparent in just in, That's been kind of the dominant narrative for, you know, 30, 40 years here in the United States of America. And I think that's something that we need to change, that this kind of crab mentality. And we need to shift to a focus that's a little more concerned with the collective well-being of our country. Because over the last 30, 40 years, the rise of this trickle down in economics and this kind of bootstrap sentiment about people holding themselves accountable for either their success or their plight, that's something that has led to historic levels of economic inequality in this country, and I mean general economic inequality, but to a very large extent racial economic inequality. Part of that narrative has been to attack government, to attack government workers. And the reason that this is particularly bad for people of color is, for black folk in particular, is because black workers are 30% more likely than the general workforce to be working in the federal government. And on top of that, people of color in general have a disproportionate reliance on the services of government, especially the safety net programs. So When we talk about an austerity agenda, you know, reducing the deficit, cutting government public programs, we're talking, if that's shared across the board, then that's obviously going to have a disproportionate impact on people of color who, as you mentioned earlier, are dealing with both historic and contemporary barriers to upward economic mobility.
Well, of course, Mazhar Ali, the co-author of United for a Fair Economy's new report, State of the Dream 2011, Austerity for Whom, this whole business of the rediscovery or the discovery of deficits has captured the narrative. I mean, and everybody is talking about austerity, you know, Republican and Democratic governors and mayors in particular. And of course, a lot of the agenda on the Hill now with the new Congress is seem to be targeted at Social Security, which of course is one of the few programs in the government that actually has a surplus. you got to admit that the broader debate is insane, let alone the disadvantage racial minorities in this country. I'm curious though about the legacy of racism now. I don't know whether it's a good example, but I know for the longest time the Republicans in the Congress have been thwarting a bill in the agricultural come out of the ag committees for reparations for all the black farmers who got conned out of their land in Georgia and in the South. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, it's well, there's a huge reparation settlement that's been voted on, but they can't get this money out. I mean, it's one of those things where a ton of money is waiting in terms of reparations. The facts have all been adjudicated, but the disbursement of the money is being held up. What, are there any examples in your report of or can you give us a sense of the legacy of racism in terms of economic disadvantage?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I mentioned, you know, this is something that's been building for decades. You know, government policies like the Homestead Act, which afforded settlers land and the opportunity to kind of develop some economic stability for themselves and their families, that wasn't something that was afforded to black folk in early America. You know, moving on, things like the GI Bill, which gave veterans the opportunity to obtain a higher education. You know, that also gave people the opportunity to buy a home and start building equity and generating and accumulating wealth. Again, you know, these were things that were racially exclusive, and not to mention the fact that universities were once very explicitly racially exclusive. Now, all of those things that those enable families to pass down wealth, intergenerationally. Now, if some folks were afforded certain opportunities that others were not, then it makes sense that those with more opportunities are going to have more wealth to pass down to their children and to their children, so on and so forth, whereas people of color have not generally had those luxuries. And then when we talk about the way our tax system, for instance, works, there's a lot of preferential treatment for wealth. And for income that is made from the possession of wealth, investment income, for example, you know, when we talk about capital gains income, for example, we've got black Americans receiving 13 cents and Latino Americans receiving 8 cents for each dollar of white dividend income. I'm sorry, that was dividend income. With capital gains, black Americans have 12 cents and Latinos have 10 cents for each dollar of unrealized capital gains in a white family. Now, that in and of itself is evidence of historical advantage for white families over black and Latino families. And it wasn't just that black people didn't work as hard or that Latino people didn't work as hard. It was just that historically they had greater opportunities to amass that wealth.
So, do you think that as the Latino population increases in this country, and as more and more Latinos start voting, because that was one of the biggest voting blocks that didn't show up? I mean, the African American voting block is largely pretty reliable, and you know, shows up fairly regularly. Although quite often there's a lot of voter suppression, and we've certainly seen examples of that. But I'm correct, am I not, Marley, in suggesting that in terms of showing up at the polls, African Americans are very, very you know, loyal voters, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, of course, and I think that in too large a part, you know, you're right. We're not getting enough people out to the polls, and it's not just that. Voter mobilization is failing. It's not just that, because it really is an issue of community organizing.
By the way, that I don't mean to interrupt, but that's not to say that the Republicans haven't been hostile to this. They shut down Acorn, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and they will continue to fight tooth and nail for such an agenda, for an agenda that is, well, essentially the status quo. And, you know, we spoke earlier about this tax deal that got kind of pushed through with little to no room for negotiation towards the end of the year, certainly to the loud opposition of folks all over the country. But, yeah, I mean, they will fight tooth and nail to maintain this status quo. And it's they won't make it easy. But that highlights all the work that needs to be done in terms of community education. You know, not just getting people out to the polls, but getting folks out there making informed decisions about what's happening.
Well, the reason I bring it up all the time is that I know that your report has been inspired by Martin Luther King, and there's no question that closing the economic divide in this country was a core objective of Dr. Martin Luther King. And particularly in the final years of his life, that's what he was about. So that's why I sort of refer to it often, and it seems to be, you know, appropriate to some extent. I think all middle class and working Americans are in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an austerity agenda is going to perpetuate general inequality in the United States. It's not going to be good for anybody, even for the super wealthy who are making millions off of these tax breaks. Ultimately, it's just not going to be good, even if we are talking about certain, job creators. I mean, if there's not a consumer base because the rest of the country is too poor to go and buy goods and services, it's obviously not going to be good for anybody. And so far, again, especially with this tax deal that got pushed through at the end of the year, we're not doing anything different there. It is the extension of the status quo and the postponement of more pain. This is something, more tax breaks and service cuts. This is something that's been happening for decades, and I think we should recognize that it's time for a different approach, a different strategy, a bold strategy. And that's going to be, we're talking about, we need to shift gears. We just need to totally shift gears. And because these attacks on government, as I mentioned earlier, like Grover Norquist said, he wanted to shrink government to a size that he could drown it in a bathtub. Government has been shrinking, and opportunity for our most marginalized communities have been shrinking. That's why we're in this great recession. And the only way that we're going to be able to turn it around is to start doing something different. So, with this overrepresentation of people of color in the public sector, we should be looking to build that. We should be looking to create more jobs in the public sector that would make the recovery possible, and that would additionally lay the foundation for longer term stability.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles on this Martin Luther King Day, Mazhar Ali. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mazhar Ali, who is the co-author of State of the Dream 2011, Austerity for Whom?, a new report published by United for a Fair Economy that examines the effects conservative fiscal policies have had upon African Americans, Latinos, and other minority groups that have suffered disproportionately from the economic downturn. We'll take a short break, and we'll return in a moment and do an assessment of the Obama foreign policy and national security team.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined by Roger Morris, who's an author and historian. He served in the United States Foreign Service, on the White House staff, and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His critically acclaimed books on American politics include Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, 1913 to 1952, Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America, and Strategic Demands of the 21st Century, New Vision for a New World. He's completing a new book on the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American foreign policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris. You there, Roger? Apparently not. Roger?
Hello, Ian.
Oh, there you are. So tell me, Roger, there's a couple of things that sort of triggered my interest in doing an update on where we stand and how effective President Obama's national security and foreign policy team are. Obviously, there was a sense of the loss that they feel for Richard Holbrooke. I was looking at the sort of those of eulogizing, and it sort of struck me that, you know, one of the perennial problems that the Democrats have is that they just haven't controlled the executive branch as much as the Republicans have, and then they really don't have a very deep bench in terms of national security.
They really have no bench at all, Ian, and even their starters were not very deep. I'm not sure how many people are really mourning the passing of Dick Holbrooke. I know it's not protocol, as my grandmother taught me, to speak ill of the dead, but this was one of the more problematic characters in the history of American diplomacy, and symbolic in so many ways of the decay related to the generation of diplomacy and diplomats from a sense of civic spirit and sacrifice and patriotism, really, sacrificed in this case to private greed and ambition. He was an extraordinary hustler. And therefore not very well respected or liked by the people who really worked closely with him. I don't think Hillary Clinton, who is, as we all know, I think in unknown territory for her for the most part, is going to miss him that much. He was, as she even said at the memorial service, a headache for her part of the time, and of course he won't be missed at all by the military who abhorred him almost from the beginning of his association with them in Vietnam 40 years ago. So I think it'll be very, very mixed reviews.
But surely, Roger Morris, that there is a crisis in civil military affairs in the United States. Never before have the military been so brazen in their attempts to control and shape U.S. foreign policy, the extent to which they bullied the president into their accounted insurgency strategy in Afghanistan. I think that is the real issue, isn't it? I mean,
well, absolutely.
Civilians are getting rolled, whether they're Democrats.
One of Holbrooke's legacies, really, that there was no assertion. It would have been a reassertion after the Bush years of civilian authority anywhere in that theater of operations. Certainly none in Iraq to begin with, and never any in Afghanistan. A series even under the Bush administration, Khalilzad, who was the pro-counsel from Washington, had minimal authority. No, the military's been running this, Ian, as you well know, and Petraeus is now the viceroy for that part of the world. And in those circles, Dick Holbrooke was a joke. We know from the Rolling Stone article and from other sources and now from WikiLeaks, he was scarcely taken seriously. No one at the Department of State was taken seriously by the military. Even their own former generals like Ambassador Eikenberry were cut out. I mean, this is a military-dominated foreign policy and has been for some time. The absence of any true diplomats who actually knew the area, who were exercising authority, who could speak directly to the president and could carry the day in Washington and in Kabul, has been absolutely fatal.
Well, there's one great diplomat I know who Obama tried to appoint to head up his National Intelligence Council, Chaz Freeman. And he got run out of town by AIPAC, the Israeli lobby.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure, you know, my feeling about that debacle from the moment it was concluded was one could never be sure of what Freeman would have been able to accomplish even if he'd gotten the job. Again, this is in terms of AIPAC and its control over the policy process in Washington, it's as total as the military's control over policy and in the field in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the Middle East.
There's actually an interesting addition to that, and that is that the Indians have developed a lobby along the lines of AIPAC, and they are clearly showing tremendous results for India, because arguably the United States are spectators at their own war, which is effectively a surrogate war in Afghanistan between India and Pakistan.
Well, India, of course, has the virtue, like the Pakistanis, of knowing what they want out of this, and of having an agenda. They know what they don't want. They don't want any interference in Kashmir. They don't want a creative American policy that would link the problems between India and Pakistan to the problems in Afghanistan. Though that, of course, is one of the magic wands that Obama could have waved and done a great deal with. I think the Indians are reasserting themselves in a grand way, which makes, of course, the situation with the Pakistanis all the more desperate, all the more intransigent, because that's exactly what they've always been afraid of.
Well, specifically in terms of Holbrooke, in his defense, when he took that job, his first attempt was to put to make Kashmir a part of his portfolio.
Yes, and the Indians vetoed that.
Right. Well, that's
they made it very plain that he would not be welcome. It was not to be the AFPAC Indian representative of the President of the United States. But you know, as in all of these cases, the ultimate buck stops in the Oval Office. The responsibility for all of this comes back to Obama, because it was, of course, his foreign policy. He could have defined that role any way he chose. He chose instead to treat the Indians almost as he's treated the Republicans, to mollify and to appease and to ignore the very real differences. But in the end, of course, the Pakistanis are the heart of the problem and will be always in Afghanistan until there is some kind of lasting détente, some kind of lasting peace between India and Pakistan, because that's of course the western flank that must be secured, and the temptation to meddle and to manipulate and to control is inexhaustible.
Well, presumably that was what at least Holbrooke understood. That's why he wanted the Kashmir account, in order to bring about a peace deal between India and Pakistan, because obviously until you do that, the Pakistani military are not going to cooperate in Afghanistan.
You know, I think that's true, and that just goes back to the ultimate price of public service and policy on one side versus personal aggrandizement on the other. I don't think Dick Holbrooke, though he understood that, must have understood that, as most informed people do in this field, was ever willing to put his career, his office, much of anything else on the line. You know, when I knew him, and I've known him ever since he served in the Phoenix program in Vietnam in the 1960s, when he was on the Paris peace delegation under Averell Harriman, when he worked for Nicholas Katzenbach as Undersecretary of State. I worked with him very closely, just an office away at the Carnegie Endowment, when he edited Foreign Policy magazine, and then I watched him through the Carter administration, and then again through the Clinton years, and in the interim, his business pursuits with Mondale Chief of Staff Jim Johnson in the Reagan years, and all of the shenanigans with Wall Street. Dick Holbrooke had opportunity after opportunity to act on the kind of strategic insight you're talking about, to act on the larger purpose, and in each case, he really acted on behalf of Dick Holbrooke, and that's what happened, as you well know, in the Balkans with that settlement. The ironic title of his book, "To End a War," which was to say to replace what would have been a Serbian federation of some kind with all these mafia regimes in the Balkans, none of which are stable, all of which are coming apart. The Bosnians, as well as the Kosovo regime, and I think one of the more humorous, one of the more ironic tributes I saw to Holbrooke was Alexander Coburn's column in The Nation. Could a Serbian heart have saved Dick Holbrooke, referring to the regime that he planted there, which has now been fingered by the European community for a thriving trade in body parts as well as narcotics and everything else.
With the Prime Minister of the Kosovo, the Kosovo, the state that we created,
And
being indicted for heading up a ring of organ smugglers.
Yeah, and you know, it used to be said on the point of American bayonets. I guess we don't do bayonets anymore, but we certainly do airstrikes and armored personnel carriers and Humvees. And yeah, he was very much our creature, and as was this regime in Bosnia, which the Serbs are now suffering the kind of discrimination, not the genocide, God knows, but who knows what lies in the future. And I think if you seek Dick Holbrooke's monument, you look around at everything he left behind in Southeast Asia, in the Phoenix program, in the support for Pol Pot, in the devastation of East Timor, and then on to the Balkans, and then finally, of course, to AFPAC, where he did have an opportunity with his obvious stature and experience and the gravitas that that democratic politicians like the Clintons gave him, ceded to him, in public office and all the rest, did have an opportunity to challenge this military dominance of American foreign policy, which you and I understand is so pernicious and in the long run lethal to democracy. So I was not sorry, in fact, to see him go. I think if there's any chance that this administration can recoup anything in that part of the world, it needs fresh thinking all around. I saw an article in the Canadian press saying, gee, why doesn't Canada produce a Canadian Holbrooke? I mean, they should reassess. thank God they haven't. Mm. And the one chance Hillary Clinton has, and I think President Obama has, to get out of this mess with anything intact is to find a replacement for Holbrooke who really does know the area, who really is pursuing something beyond their own personal agenda and their own fame and fortune, and because it is indeed a very thorny problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, author and historian, served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, and is completing a history of U.S. Covert and overt relations in the Middle East and South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And just touching on Hillary Clinton, she did preempt to a small degree what is now happening in Tunisia, in as much as she warned the Arab foreign ministers a few days before the government fell about their repressive regimes being out of touch with the people. However, what was missing there is the fact that the U.S. And the French in particular, for 23 years, thought this Tunisian strongman, who turned out to have a wife who was a kleptocrat and a disgusting family of thieves, who was completely out of touch with his people, according to the WikiLeaks documents that were leaked. But as long as he was an anti-Islamist and he created that magic word that we always talk about in American foreign policy, stability, nobody seemed to notice this guy until his dictatorship became untenable.
Well, it's a classic story of American policy in the region. We noticed him, of course, in terms of CIA involvement and subsidies under the table, and I think WikiLeaks may eventually at least refer to that, although WikiLeaks, the limit of that leak is that American diplomats, for the most part, the kind of cable traffic that that WikiLeaks was able to release doesn't tell the full story by any means. Nowhere is the United States in South Asia or the Middle East able to lecture anyone on democracy or on dictatorship, because we have been the main supporters, covertly and overtly, of every repressive regime across the region. Of course, there's even an irony in Hillary Clinton lecturing anyone on democracy in Tunisia after coming out of Arkansas, but that's another whole story, as you know, Ian. No, this is the ultimate hypocrisy. Americans don't understand it. They take it somewhat at face value because they don't really know the hidden history of their own country's conduct abroad. Foreign chancelleries and diplomatic services, of course, simply take it in stride because they know that it's another case of cynicism and hypocrisy out of Washington. We will embrace the new regime, whatever it is. We will certainly try to co-opt it as soon as possible. We don't want any more Gaddafis in North Africa. We don't want any more loose cannons. Especially at this point, one can only hope that there is something like a genuine intifada in Tunisia that will issue in something like a genuine democratic regime that will break that American skein and will invite imitation by other governments. But my goodness, think of the dominoes here, to use the 1960s term. Think of the dominoes that can fall in terms of Algeria, of Egypt, of Jordan, and of course Lebanon, where we're seeing the developing crisis there, which is a result of very much of American policy. This is the reward, the reckoning of American policy in the 1980s and 90s.
So, but Roger, how do you navigate that, given the legacy of our foreign policy in the Middle East, and the extent to which we're getting some blowback from using Islamists to fight Arab socialists, and now you've got this situation where you've got these corrupt regimes that we've supported over the decades, essentially waiting in the wings are the Islamists, who in many cases are all about one vote, one time, and then you have an Islamic Republic.
I think you navigate that, Ian, as Bob Baer and others have said, by speaking truth not only to power here and abroad, but by speaking truth to the Arab street. By Barack Obama coming to terms with a history of American foreign policy he doesn't even seem to begin to understand, what it's really been, acknowledging the hypocrisy, acknowledging the double standard, acknowledging our culpability. I mean, he was able to get a few lines out about American responsibility in the 1953 overthrow of Mossadegh, as if that were the original and only American sin in that part of the world. I mean, it simply begins a 50-year and more history of similar outrages, coups, and even more important than a dramatic coup d'etat, it's this ongoing furtive support for people like the Tunisian dictator, for people like Mubarak in Egypt, and that oligarchy, and the Jordanian regime, and all the rest across the region.
And you don't think, though, that essentially we have a Hobson's choice here, that what's waiting for Mubarak to fall and the Muslim Brotherhood, the same is true, I think, in Jordan.
I think it's the riskiest moment that we have faced in the Third World, far riskier than anything we faced in the post-colonial period with the Soviets and with those piddling communist parties that never really had much of a chance, although we were intent on destroying them physically as well as politically. Yes, it's an unenviable choice, but I think it's really the only one we have, because what the Tunisian case shows is that it's not tenable anymore to support these people indefinitely. There is a wave, ironically. I think W was right. George W. Bush was more or less correct that there is a wave of democratic idealism and impulse across the Middle East, and certainly that's true in South Asia as well. I think it's much stronger in Afghanistan than anybody gives it credit for being, and that wave is there, and America does not speak to it, nor does it really put its chips where it says it will put them. And until we do that, I think we cede the field. If one is afraid of Islamist regimes, one is afraid of the radicals taking over, the surest avenue to that is to continue this hypocrisy, to continue to isolate and to ignore, in some cases to destroy, the democratic elements in these society, the more secular, more pro-Western elements, because in the long run they will be pro-Western, whatever their short-term expedience is.
Well, we sure gone after some secular regimes, which have been replaced by religious ones, like Iraq being an example. I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who has written a number of important books on American foreign policy, Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America, Strategic Demands of the 21st Century, and he is completing a new book on the history of U.S. relations in the Middle East and in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. We'll take a short station break, and we'll be joined in the studio by the maker of the documentary, The Best Government Money Can Buy, and we'll look into whether the new Congress is indeed the best money that money has bought.
On the next edition of Uprising, we'll look at gun laws across the United States, how they made Jared Loughner's work easier, and what new laws, if any, could emerge. And William Hartung will join us to discuss his new book, Profits of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, plus the first of a three-part series on what happens to public school teachers when they dare to speak up about incompetence and corruption. Join me, Sonali Kolhatkar, on Uprising weekdays at 8 a.m. right here at KPFK.
You're going to be able to see my crew.
And hello and welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Francis McGaughey, who's a veteran TV and film writer, director, and producer. His documentary, The Best Government Money Can Buy, presented a behind-the-scenes comprehensive and nonpartisan examination of the system of lobbying in Washington, D.C. He joins us in the studio today to talk about what can be expected from the new Congress. And already it seems, Francis, that we are seeing all of this grandstanding over this futile vote on repealing health care. We noticed that the new Speaker of the House, John Boehner, did not show up for the memorial in Tucson because he was doing a fundraiser instead. And now we find that the new head of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Darrell Issa, who has charged the Obama administration as being the most corrupt in history, who has already sent out 150 letters of solicitation to the biggest, most powerful corporate lobbies in Washington asking for their wish lists, he now finds himself the target of a devastating investigation in The New Yorker.
Yes, it'll be very interesting to see how that affects his activities. I was amused by him sending out the 150 letters because that struck me as inviting a bunch of foxes to a discussion about whether or not we should fence the hen house. And I can't imagine that the smoke screen sent up by the factory which he owned and increased the insurance of and then collected it after it burnt down isn't somehow going to blow across his committee and affect what he does.
And the number of cars he stole.
Yes.
And the fact that him and his brothers.
Well, his brother stole them. His brother stole
them. Right, but they were. He wasn't a slouch. These were Maseratis, right?
Yes, one of them was a pretty good car, that's right. True, yes. And of course, another one he had to be driving, which had a gun in the glove locker that was loaded, which naturally he didn't know anything about.
Yes, along with a flare gun as well.
Yes.
Yes. And somehow he in his resume about his stellar military service, there's apparently an alternative narrative there.
Yes, he insists, and he also insists that he was Nixon's bodyguard, but the records seem to show otherwise, and of course, we can't ask President Nixon anymore.
No. Well, he may just be a kind of, garden variety blowhard, but he is the head of an important committee. Mm-hmm. And we did have Henry Waxman in charge of the last one. And it seems that what happens, and Waxman did look into some important issues, it seems that these Republicans, the last time around, all they investigated was steroids and sports. They either want to use these committees, use the subpoena power to harass the Democrats, or go off on some tangent like the repeal of healthcare, which is largely theatrical.
So well, that's the trouble.
What's the real agenda, though? I mean, is it the politics of distraction?
I think the real agenda is to clog up the works with legal paperwork. You know, it requires a lot of manpower and stuff to deal with a lot of subpoenas. You have to respond to them. The White House can't be non-responsive. It's got to have some response. If it fights them, doesn't want to send the documents, doesn't want to submit people for interviews, whatever it happens to be before a committee, it all takes time. And it gums up the works. And, you know, there'd be no more effective way of preventing Obama from having a second term, as Mitch McConnell has indicated his main ambition for the next 2 years, than by just paralyzing the administration.
So you went to Washington, though, as a sort of citizen journalist, to make a documentary to find out where the power, the real power, resides in Washington. And you found out that the real power is in the lobbyists. And it seems to me that lobbying is an equal opportunity operation. It seems that there's a revolving door for both Democrats and Republicans where they trade government service into private gain the minute they can. And there used to be a kind of waiting period, but they've reduced that down.
Well, they don't register.
Yeah.
The way they get around a lot of it is they don't register. I mean, Tom Daschle was a good example. You know, when he was out of office, he worked for a law firm which had large health company clients like Healthcare South, and he didn't lobby, in inverted commas. He gave them strategic advice.
And his wife worked for one of them.
And his wife worked for one as well. And, you know, that's sort of traditional, you know, because now Baron Dorgan is no longer working for the people. He has become a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. And we now can see that the media, for some reason, has decided to expose facts which have been there all the time and they never bothered to look at. Mm-hmm. And his wife was the principal lobbyist for the insurance industry, which wanted to retain death taxes. And that was also an agenda of Mr. Dorgan's, which was oddly at odds with a lot of his other positions. But, of course, the insurance industry wants to retain death taxes because people take out enormous insurance policies against them in order to safeguard their fortunes that they want to pass on to their heirs.
Mm-hmm.
And
by the way, you're using the Republican term for death taxes.
Yes, that's right, I am. Yeah, 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 that's
which
right.
Is,
well, that shows how effective their phrase-making
exactly,
is. You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I'll be using death panels next.
Right.
But, yeah, that's right, estate taxes, as yeah. we call them in my country of origin.
Right.
And
there's a slight difference, though. I mean, maybe there's not a difference, but to the extent to which these Democrats are going immediately out of government into lobbying, the opposite's happening with Senator Dan Coats of Indiana. He's come from lobbying back into government.
Mm-hmm.
He was a lobbyist for the mm-hmm. petroleum, whatever the umbrella group for the refiners of petroleum is. So he's, you know, he's well positioned, as all of them are. So what, if you found out as a documentarian, a documentary filmmaker and a citizen journalist, if you discovered that the real power in Washington are the lobbyists and the extent to which they fund the candidates, fund the incumbents, keep them in power. We know that the new Speaker of the House, Boehner, found it more important to be with a lobbyist.
And he wasn't the only one.
At a fundraiser.
Yeah, he wasn't the only one some of the new guys didn't swear in.
Oh, that's right. They swore in on television.
They said they swore in on television, but that was disallowed. The votes they cast were disallowed.
Right, but they were actually at a fundraiser.
But they were actually at a fundraiser.
On their first day.
Yes. Yeah. So, whereas normally they wait till the second day.
I see. So tell me about how this system works. I mean,
well, let me tell you something I think that casts an interesting light on the Tea Party candidates, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Tea Party candidates have suffered a certain amount of ridicule for being hypocritical in that they attacked the entrenched Washington way of doing things. And, of course, with the speed of light, they've hired lobbyists as their chiefs of staff. They've had fundraisers in order to recover the expenses of the elections they won. which is a very disturbing way of giving money, to paying them back for an election they already won, because now they owe you a favour, not for the election, but for whatever they're going to do next. But we have placed them in a position where they don't have any choice. Now, I believe we should be sceptical about politicians, about anybody who wants to go into politics. But the fact is, there are a lot of good people who want to go into politics and want to do something good for the country. If you want to do something good for the country, you obviously would like to keep your seat. You're not going to do too much in 2 years if you're in the House. And if you don't spend 40% of your time raising money, you will not be there in 2 years' time. And this applies whether you're somebody I sympathize with in their political views or whether I don't. They simply don't have any choice. And
now, does this apply to, say, a Maxine Waters?
Oh, yes.
Who's got a safe seat?
I mean, yes,
why does she, what does she need the money for?
Because somebody else can come along for that safe seat who might be beat her in the primary. You've got to win the primary, first of all. You never know. There may be a faction in her constituency which thinks she's been there too long. Mm. We need some new blood. We want a more radical approach or a more conservative approach. So you just don't have any choice. You've got to raise money. And that's where the power of the lobbyist comes in. Lobbyists are not per se bad people with evil intentions. I'm very happy about having lobbyists. I think people should get a chance to express those points of view. It's when they have a checkbook that the whole system becomes distorted. We have lobbyists in Britain, and they have lobbyists in every European country and at the European Parliament, but they can't give you money to get elected. And it's very depressing when you see analysis of the way members vote on particular bills which favour or disfavour particular industries, and invariably, the members who vote the way the industries would like the bill to go get several times as much in campaign money from those industries as the members who don't. And unfortunately, these votes are in effect for sale.
Again, joined in the studio by Francis McGahey, who made the documentary The Best Government Money Can Buy. He's a documentarian and citizen journalist who went to Washington, D.C. to find out who wields the real power in our nation's capital, and we're talking about the people who do, the lobbyists. So have I got it wrong? Because I thought that the safe seats on the Democratic side and the safe seats on the Republican side tend to be, either if you're a Republican, they tend to be very, very right-wing conservative districts, and you know, like Utah and places like that. And on the left, you know, inner city minority representatives usually have safe seats, and that the people in the swing districts, whether they swing from Democrat to Republican, are the ones that need the most money, and that the ones that the lobbyists go after.
Well, obviously,
I was told that the prime spot for a freshman congressman is to get on the banking committee, because that's where they throw money at you.
Well, they absolutely do. And if you look at the chap who was going to be in charge of the subcommittee, which is going to supervise the implementation and regulation of the recent finance reform bill, 96% of his campaign funds came from one single hedge fund. Now, how on earth can anybody think that's all right? How can you have 96% of your money coming from one single company, and the disposition of your activities will affect their profits?
Well, but the Supreme Court, in its recent ruling, has in effect allowed a situation. Now, this is hypothetical, but it's absolutely credible, and that is that in 2012, a billionaire could find some candidate to run against Obama and spend $1 billion.
That's true.
Wouldn't have to reveal who he was or she was.
No, that's true. That's why we've got to get private money and corporation money and union money out of elections. We've got to have publicly funded elections. That's the only solution. I've thought about this a lot, and there's really no other way other than publicly funded elections. And the sad thing is, we're never going to get publicly funded elections from proposals from congressmen and senators. They're much, much too scared to, you know, rock the boat that got them into the safe haven they're occupying so very comfortably.
Well, but we're heading in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Everything indicates, particularly the Supreme Court ruling, and with this new Congress, because they're on a feeding frenzy now.
Yes, and you know, in every, and it's not just in elections, It's equally important in what people do after they're elected. And the power of some of these lobbies, as you know, is incredible. I mean, the NRA has recently been able to stop the ATF in its campaign to prevent the smuggling of weapons into Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's absolutely outrageous.
No, they've got the Teilhard Amendment that ties the hands of, and that's just one congressman somewhere from the Midwest.
That's right.
And I'm astounded that nobody, particularly after the
particularly after the massacre, it's amazing that there's not been a national outcry about it.
Yeah, but remember, in the Disclose Act, that was supposed to fix the most egregious part of the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United, which mm-hmm. was supposed to force all these big money people and corporations and unions to say who they were when you ran a campaign commercial. You know, I'm Exxon and I brought you this candidate.
Right.
And that Disclose Act was shot down by a filibuster in the Senate. But before that happened, the Democrats had agreed to a waiver to allow the NRA exemption from the Disclose Act. Gives you an idea of the power
They're terrorized by the NRA.
Right.
But as you know, my view is that disclosure isn't everything. After all, we know who's giving all the money now, and nobody does anything about it.
Well, I think you know, there has to be a way to name and shame, and then get the public to recognize that the only way for the people to take back their government is for public financing.
I'd hope so. That's why I made the film.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in the studio, Francis McGaughey, who is a writer and director of the documentary The Best Government Money Can Buy. He's a citizen journalist who went to Washington. Mr. McGaughey went to Washington, and it's not pretty. Thank you for joining us today. You can learn more about our program Background Briefing and contact me through ianmasters.com. We're also on Facebook at Ian Masters Media. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and engineer Ray Peleas. And I will be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. for another daily briefing. Until then, no, another background briefing. Until then, bye for now. Sing something to me.